This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
What would a world look like where only two people remain? Would the world really be a place ravaged by war and covered in darkness and destruction like so many works of fiction now imagine it? Or would nature have reclaimed everything but what the last two carry with them, sole reminders of their past? These are the questions Andrew Kreebach asked himself when he penned The Bear, a novel about a man and his daughter, the last two humans on Earth. It's difficult to imagine that a post-apocalyptic story can be described as lovely, quiet, restorative, or any other words that carry beauty. But those are my word choices, and I spoke with Andrew Kreebach about his. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. The characters in your book, The Bear, are a father and daughter. They are referred to as the man and the girl. And the article is relevant because no other names are needed, because they're the last two humans on Earth. And this story was born out of a story you would tell to your kids?
Not the story about the last two. There's a sort of an organic process that occurred here. The story I told my children, my two sons at the time, was a story about a bear who helped my father and me find our dog, our lost dog in the woods. You know, they were young, and I had to get them to sleep because I wanted to sleep. And so I was up against it. I had to come up with some story that they wanted, because they say, tell us about life when you were a boy. And I put together three things that I've always loved: my father, our dog, and the woods in Pennsylvania where we grew up. So I just came up with this story about my father and me looking for our lost dog, Troy, and a talking bear helped us find him and take him back home. And it happened to be Christmas. And so all things went well. But then this notion, they were fine with the talking bear for years. In fact, even when they knew that, you know, there was no such thing, they would just, they'd say, hey, why don't you tell us that story about the talking bear again? So when I got to the point of wanting to write a story that took place in a part of the world that I had really come to love, because it was much like where I grew up in Pennsylvania, Jaffrey, New Hampshire, and it occurred to me after many iterations that this really would have to be a story about the last two people left, that quite naturally the bear, as a part of nature, was the first animal I turned to as that animal who would communicate with the girl. And yes, the girl and the man are nameless because they are the last two.
So the first location we're introduced to in the book is Mount Monadnock. The characters refer to it by its loose translation, the mountain that stands alone. On your website, you mentioned that you can see it from the front porch of a home you have on a pond in New Hampshire, and that this mountain was a favorite of Emerson and Thoreau. That alone brings a contemplative weight or expectation, doesn't it?
I suppose so. And I sort of, you know, this place that my wife and I found, we just found it, and I didn't really understand its place in the transcendentalist history until we got there and we started, you know, living there. And so, you know, Monadnock was a favorite of the transcendentalists. And Emerson always talks about looking west, and Thoreau is, you know, criticized for having gone to supper at Mrs. Emerson's house while he sat at Walden Pond. But I don't have a problem with that. Thoreau was trying to live deliberately in a place that was not the Great West. It was just a pond. And if you've ever been out to Walden, it's a beautiful place just to sit and think. And so when I was out fishing on this pond one day, when I was struggling with the arc of the narrative about this story, and I hadn't thought about the fact that they would be the last two, and it was kind of a misty morning, and I was looking around, and only Monadnock was sticking up on the pond above the rest of it. And it was as though I could have been alone on that pond. And I thought, it must have been beautiful for the first people who were here. It's probably just wetlands, no pond then. And then even Thoreau, looking down from that mountain, must have looked down onto Thorndike Pond and thought, oh, what a beautiful place. And then I thought, what's it going to be like for the last two? That's when it really hit me. Like, this is what the arc of the narrative is about. And so that notion of, I love that the transcendentalists would have picked this place where Monadnock is not spectacular. It's not the Tetons. It's not even 4,000 feet. It's probably the busiest mountain in the world as far as climbers go. But yet, when you stand on it, you could be alone among all these people. And so it makes sense to me that this is a place where Emerson and Thoreau would have thought about this notion of transcendentalism in a place that was just, you know, I should say that every time I go there, something surprises me in a small way. I watched a bald eagle catch a fish in its claws right out of the water once while I was swimming. There's all kinds of wildlife. My wife and I just stepped in for a swim one day, and this otter poked its head up just to make sure we were okay and popped down. And on my neighbor's property, I know where those otters spend the winter. And my neighbor, Harry Kieran, was telling me that in that section of the point, all winter long, the moss is green and the snow is melted from the warmth of the otters' bodies underneath that earth. So, yeah, expectations of meditation, but it always surprises me just how deep that meditation can go in that part of the world.
You know, you mentioned that you were at the pond when you realized what the narrative arc would be, and, you know, you came to wonder what the world would look like if there were only two people remaining. And so on your website, you wrote, and I quote, "Would the world really be a place ravaged by war and covered in darkness and destruction like so many works of fiction now imagine it? Or would nature have reclaimed everything but what the last two carry with them, sole reminders of their past?" And at one point in the book, the man admits to the girl that he doesn't understand or know what happened. And I found myself wondering, I wonder how many generations it would take after, you know, as this world is ending, for people not to know what had happened, where it wasn't passed down from generation to generation.
Right. I struggled with that. Once I decided that they would be the last two, and I knew that I was in that vein of the post-apocalyptic novel, and I was now in the vein of human extinction, how would I treat that? And it took work for me to constantly focus on the facts of the last two, on their narrative arc. So I treated the question of how many generations passed precisely by not letting the man know too much. And there's a real sort of paring down of not just generations, but of knowledge about the past that the man can and cannot have. And so that was one way I dealt with it. The other thing is I realized that the story had to stick to the story. And the story was what was the narrative arc of the man and the girl in what they're given in their time and what they do with it. So in many ways, that was what I really wanted to point to. Like, it didn't matter what happened. That's not the story. You know, McCarthy doesn't talk about what happened to the scorched earth in the road. And I think that's brilliant. It's about his characters that are searching for the fire. So ultimately, I do hope people will see that it's a story about storytelling in many ways, even if it's the last human story told. One thing I challenge readers to ask themselves is, who's telling the story of the bear? You know, and how is that possible? You know, I think the answer to the question of what happened is that it doesn't matter. What matters is how will the last two live out the time that's given them?
You know, the man doesn't know, he doesn't understand or know what happened, but he certainly has a lot to teach the girl. He teaches her so many things about survival, how to hunt, how to navigate by the stars. But he's also teaching her, and he even says this directly, quote, that everything has its end. And sometimes this can be a difficult lesson to learn.
Right, right. It goes right back to my answer about the story, is that we all have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so it's not that we're all just these stories told, but in many ways, we think of our lives as a narrative arc. We have to accept the end. And I think humans have a sort of hubris in that we believe we'll be immortal as a species. But yet, look at the short amount of time that we've been on this earth. It's mind-boggling to me, the way in which we act towards the earth when we consider what a short time we've had on this earth. And so that's where this idea of everything has its end. This is probably the most important thing the man teaches the girl, is that, you know, she has to recognize that and live. She has a part to play. She has to know what her part is and live that to the end. Even the puma, actually, in the cave, tells her the same thing that her father tells her. But we'll leave that for the reader to discover.
You know, the man had his father's books and would read to the girl from these works, Homer, Virgil, Windleberry. He taught her how to read and to write as well. And we know that some people write in order to be remembered after their death, but even these written pieces have an end, don't they?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And again, you know, what do we leave and how long will we leave it? Virgil and Homer, they're classic writers that I've always loved since my day as an undergrad reading classics. And Hilda Doolittle and Wendell Berry, I just love their poetry, and there's elements of that in there. Hilda Doolittle's poetry about sea roses, the girl has this, picks up the scent of them when they come to the ocean, her and her father. And Wendell Berry's poem, Elegy, where he talks about the fulcrum dust upon which we lift up our love. In many ways, that poem is just central to the book, where for as much as I would like to think of it as a love story, it really is an elegy, of course, too. But this idea of the fulcrum dust, I wanted that metaphor to ring throughout the book in a way that's elegiac. And so those things I put in there as, let's say, just mementos for myself. But at the same time, I'm reminding myself that even these favorite writers in their books are just stories that will, on the page, will eventually, you know, turn to dust one day. And if they survive in the oral history, in an oral history, I should say, then terrific. I would hope for that. But what are stories? But things that come and go when we need them.
You know, one of my favorite passages was when the man was teaching the girl, and here's another quote. "Animals are creatures of habit," he told her. "Their stories are written over and over again. In the snows of winter, over the dirt ground of summer, there was always a tale playing out. And it was the hunter in the end, if she was a good one, who would write the epilogue."
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that's fascinated me about being in nature is looking at the way in which story imitates nature, not the other way around, that our stories imitate nature. And there's a local hunter up in New Hampshire who turned me on to a book by an author named John Coolish. I think it was written in the 60s. It's called Bobcat Before Breakfast. And Coolish was a trapper post-World War II. A time when the area of southwestern New Hampshire was still pretty rough, and you know, there was a lot going on. And this book is really about being in the outdoors and looking at the narrative of life and wildlife. He subsequently went on to teach and gave up his life as a trapper, realizing in fact that trapping was not such a great thing to do for the wildlife. But he lived off the land and lived very close to the land with his wife and his snowshoes and his shotgun and his traps. But the main point of Coolish's book is this notion that if you stop and look and see the way it plays out, it's a dramatic stage that itself has its own beginning, middle, and end. And I just love that. I think because Coolish writes about the very place where our house is up there, those mountains and those woods and those wetlands, that spirit of the book, of his book, and his notion of living off the land, storytelling among nature, is another deep influence of the bear that I could not, you know, be informed by.
At one point in the book, a family of geese comes to the lake. The girl had never seen geese before and was surprised when the gander, protecting his family, attacked her. She felt, quote, "fear that was new to her, and yet it was somehow familiar to her as well, as though it had been there inside waiting for a long time." Talk to me about that fear. I mean, she had gone out on a 3-day solo hunting excursion before, and she had not feared nature.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great question. I thought about this a lot. You know, what would it be like? I mean, if you've ever slept outside, there's this equal amount of excitement and like, what if this isn't really my place? I belong in a house. But once you get over that, it's your place as well, if you've, you know, accepted it as such. I think I was thinking about this difference in Faulkner's novella, The Bear. The old hunter tells Ike McCaslin, you can be scared, but don't be afraid. And this is a distinction in the woods. You know, Faulkner had his own reasons to talk about that. But for me, I wondered about what the girl would have been and how she would have grown emotionally. And I think that there's no reason to be afraid of anything when she was in the context of being raised by her father, being taught the things she needed to be taught as she lived on the land. But it's the fact of the geese attacking her. She's not been in a position where she's been attacked. All of a sudden it raises this notion of fear. fears the attack of one thing by another. And she hasn't experienced this, but yet deep inside her, her experience in nature is that, but this happens. And now she knows it's happening to her. And it's only the beginning of the story of how this fear will play out. And she responds to it in the way that she and the man decide she must or will. And yet it changes as the novel goes on. I hope that readers will see in a way that it's the fear, one of the organic changes or developments in the novel with the girl is this notion of what is she afraid of and why? And how does that change? I purposely wanted those geese to be somehow a catalyst for that. They're essentially her first kill, if you will, in that learning of what nature is and does.
Shortly after the girl's 12th birthday, the girl and the man leave for the ocean because they had to harvest salt. So this journey becomes sort of a coming-of-age story at that point, and it's almost difficult to wrap my head around just how accomplished she was at age 12. I had to go back and look to see how old she was when they started that journey, and I was amazed that she was just 12.
Yeah. You know, it's part mathematical. They've got to move, and she is how old she is. But I thought, too, you know, this would be the age of the coming of age. And she is in a wholly other world and a wholly other person, maybe rightfully so. It just, you know, within my sense of the story, this was the age at which, you know, she would have to set out on that journey, which does become her own coming of age. So one thing that's curious about writing is I wonder if readers really think about the way in which writers have to consider pace and time. Time is one of the things as a writer that I think the most about, I have to say. But, you know, I think I just think about it and work it out in a story. And each story, it's worked out differently.
Talk to me about listening and learning from nature, because you write in the book, quote, "Long ago, all the animals knew how to make the sounds the girl and her father used between them. But it was the others like her who stopped listening, so the skill was lost."
Let me start this way. I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, in a pretty rural part of the state. A lot of folks who did outdoor things around me. I was outside all the time, but I also love books a great deal. I'm a lot more bookish than your average bear, if you will. But the outdoors really just became a part of my life and always has been. So I think in some ways this return to rural New Hampshire has given me a look back on that early part of the life, which I've missed. I've lived in cities most of my life, London, New York, Boston now. So it's a coming back for me. It's a turning around. And one thing that part of New Hampshire has taught me to do is just to sit and listen now. Maybe it's because I'm much older than I was in the days when I couldn't listen and I needed to move. And I find that the less than sublime landscape of the Monadnock region, it's not the Tetons, it's not anything that you would say, oh, wow, how beautiful, until you really look closely, until you really listen closely. And I placed the book there precisely because of its oldness. In its rounded off edges, that these are the places where if we listen hardest, you get the voices of the old, you get time, you get a sense of story that's much deeper. And I think no matter where we are, though, in front of us, there are things that will call that up. And this is just my education about listening more to nature, listening more deeply. And, you know, it's helped me in my own relationships with my wife and my children and just generally in life around me. But I think that idea, I don't think the bear would be the bear. The prose wouldn't be the prose. The pacing would be the pacing, unless I had taken that time to stop and just sit on the mountain or on the pond and listen to what was around me, rather than thinking somehow I had it figured out.
We do not hear trees speak in this book, but it's suggested that the trees taught the animals to speak, quote, "because they never make an unnecessary sound." When I read that, my first thought was, are you a fan of Narnia?
I'm not. I'm not a C.S. Lewis fan, but I am a Tolkien fan. And so, yes, if there's an element of the Ents in there without the grand, you know, fantastic marching of the Ents, that's sort of, but that element of what nature in a Middle Earth did and perhaps in our own earth can do is definitely there. And I'll admit too, to it, never having read Richard Powers' The Overstory. When I heard about this book, I was finished with The Bear, actually. I thought, oh man, this is incredible. So I have it. I have never read it. An interviewer once said to me, when I confessed to never having read Richard Powers, he said, maybe there's just something in the zeitgeist now with respect to nature, where people are really coming to believe and to see that, in fact, this is not so fabulous. This is not so fantastical. And I have read, actually, a lot of work. I forget, is a German forester. I've heard the podcast and I've read his books about the social nature of trees. I think it's called The Secret Life of Trees. And foresters and scientists know now that trees are social animals, that they protect the young, that they communicate for thousands of miles or perhaps hundreds of miles. They communicate when drought is coming. They have a great relationship, symbiotic relationship with fungi. They've even found salmon DNA in the rings of old trees because of this way in which fungi feed trees over the centuries. I think this is, you know, it's actually becoming science and not a fantasy. But to answer your question, no, I'm not a fan of Narnia and and haven't been so. But certainly a fan of trees, yes.
So you talked about how you would tell your boys a story, and when you had a daughter, it became a story of a man and a girl. Would this story be as compelling if it weren't a girl, if it were a boy, if it weren't for your daughter?
I don't know. But what that did, what that opened up for me was this. It opened up the question of, you know, what? Well, first of all, let me speak theologically for a minute. That it always seemed to me that in the creation myth, if the first one was a man, then I think it's only fitting that the last should be a woman. So I smiled at myself when I came to that notion at the end of the novel. But also, you know, the question of, are they really the last? Is she really the last? You know, is there some way where there's someone else out there and they have children and there's a new rebirth of humankind? That's not the story I wrote. Would the story be different with a boy instead of a girl? You know, I suppose it would be. But in that sense, I'm, you know, doubly glad for my daughter that she came along and this changed. And, you know, it's an old woman who takes us right to the end. So, yeah.
We were communicating last week on the eve of the summer solstice, which is significant in the book. And you were at the house in New Hampshire, sitting at that pond. You told me you were contemplating the coming solstice. Right. Any new discovery of wisdom?
No, just no new wisdom, just a sort of reconsidering the fact that we've been here such a short time and nature around us has been here such a long, long time that I'm not worried about nature. But if things continue to go as they do among the way humans act within nature, I am worried about humankind. And so I was just thinking about the way in which we should listen more, to go back to your an earlier question, and that anyone, I hope that anyone who reads the book would sort of stop next time and look at what's in front of them. You know, it might be a grand mountain. It might be a, you know, an oak tree. It might just be prairie grass. It could be a stretch of river that's just meandering by their front door. But just stop and think about it. Think about how long that's been around. And is there a particular hubris we need to, I don't know, get rid of before we can act appropriately with some care and some wisdom and just this desire to be good stewards of this land around us, which was here before us and, you know, quite possibly, probably, in fact, will be here for a lot longer after us.
That was Andrew Krivok, author of the book The Bear, which was published by Bellevue Literary Press. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Stasser and Torin Anderson. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.